Blog Talk Radio.
If the eyes of all could only once be opened, and our ears could hear them pray. Wouldn't the skies above ring out with the cries and joyous shouts of mighty wonder?
Paper 139, The 12 Apostles. It is an eloquent testimony to the charm and righteousness of Jesus' earth life that, although he repeatedly dashed to pieces the hopes of his apostles and tore to shreds their every ambition for personal exaltation, only one deserted him. The apostles learned from Jesus about the kingdom of heaven, and Jesus learned much from them about the kingdom of men. Human nature, as it lives on Urantia and on the other evolutionary worlds of time and space. These 12 men represented many different types of human temperament, and they had not been made alike by schooling. Many of these Galilean fishermen carried heavy strains of Gentile blood as a result of the forcible conversion of the Gentile population of Galilee 100 years previously. Do not make the mistake of regarding the apostles as being altogether ignorant and unlearned. All of them, except the Alpheus twins, were graduates of the synagogue schools, having been thoroughly trained in the Hebrew scriptures and in much of the current knowledge of that day. Seven were graduates of the Capernaum synagogue schools, and there were no better Jewish schools in all Galilee. When your records refer to these messengers of the kingdom as being ignorant and unlearned, it was intended to convey the idea that they were laymen, unlearned in the lore of the rabbis and untrained in the methods of rabbinical interpretation of the scriptures. they were lacking in so-called higher education. In modern times, they would certainly be considered uneducated, and in some circles of society, even uncultured. One thing is certain, they had not all been put through the same rigid and stereotyped educational curriculum. From adolescence on, they had enjoyed separate experiences of learning how to live.
Hello. Hello? Am I on the Cosmic Citizen yet? Good morning.
There's nothing on the air.
No.
Andre, are you
there? Is
still
something
there?
On the air. We're on the air right now. I can hear us.
Okay,
just
well,
barely.
I guess we will go ahead and talk about the show.
Well, apparently we're on the air, so welcome everyone to the Cosmic Citizen. It's Andre Rodatis and Crystalline Beke Larson here on the show. Paula Thompson is away on business today, and we're glad to have you on the show. We just started with a little clip, and that clip was the beginning of Paper 139, The 12 Apostles, and that's what we're broadcasting on today. Sorry for any confusion, but here we are. We're finally on the air. I'm not sure how our volume is. If you can give us some feedback on that. It's hard for me to get direct feedback from where I am right now. Okay. Crystalline, how are you today? Okay. Apparently we're having some technical difficulties this morning, so I don't know if I'm still broadcasting. Yes, I am. So today we're doing the 12 Apostles. My co-host is about to come back on the air, Crystalline Beke Larson. Last week we were talking about the first two of the apostles, that is the first two apostles that had been chosen. And those two apostles were none other than Andrew and Peter. And we talked about a lot of their personality characteristics, the fact that Andrew was in very many ways one of the most versatile apostles, very much like Jesus in terms of his versatility, and a natural leader, eldest of his family, and as a result was chosen to lead the apostles. Simon Peter was extremely eloquent. And we read and heard a lot about how he was, Peter's fervency carried him through to be a great winner of souls to the kingdom. And by that we mean with the gospel of the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God primarily, even though it began to change after Jesus left and ascended back up to Salvington, even though he became more and more focused on the Lord Jesus Christ himself, Jesus of Nazareth as God and man, and strayed away from the gospel, the pure gospel message. Today what we're going to do is we're going to study James and John Zebedee. And James and John were both fisher folk. They were And
hello, Andre. Can you hear me? This is God's Gumshoe.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh,
I
great.
I think we're on
great.
The air, God's Gumshoe.
Yeah, I Skyped in, and I think my Skype went off for a minute or two. I had Chrislyn on the board, but I don't. She must have got bumped off. Maybe if you're listening, Chrislyn, and you can hear us, give us a call back in. So, Andre, yes, good job. Thank you very much for introducing us there. So we've got the board working up here, and I see at 3:03. So maybe this is Chrislyn. Let's see if this is Chrislyn.
Probably.
Good morning, Chrislyn. Is that you?
Good morning, yes.
Oh,
so
great, good.
Apparently we've had some major technical problems this morning, but it sounds like things are running along a little bit better now.
Yes, well, we got
yes,
the show
we're all
on
the line.
Anyway, we managed to start at on time, if nothing else. Great.
Very
well,
good.
I hope our guests will bear with us, so...
I think they are.
Well,
I think they're all bearing with us, and so... let's continue, and I was just letting people know that we're on with talking about James and John Zebedee, and we're ready to go forward with that. We might.
And have you station identified and given out the phone number for anyone who would like to call in?
Well, why don't you do that since you're in the process of doing so right now?
Well, just for those who may have missed the beginning of the program, or if they didn't have sound at the beginning of the program, you're with us on Cosmic Citizen, and today we are discussing the personalities of the 12 apostles as per paper 138 in the Urantia book. And we are reading about James and John Zebedee. And if you'd like to call in, our number is 646-716-8158.
And
that's
646-716-8158.
It's paper 139.
Paper yeah, 139, not 138. Sorry.
No. Very
okay,
good.
So where did we stop reading last week?
I think that we ended at the end of Simon Peter, and I'd like to eat a little humble pie on that. In that last week, I said that Peter's wife was at his crucifixion and calling on him to continue preaching to his accusers and his crucifiers, and I was mistaken. It wasn't Peter and Peter's wife. It was Philip and Philip's wife. So slight correction on that last week element, and we'll cover that if we get to Philip today.
That's correct. Yeah, I remember that in my reading for the show today. So why don't we since we're going to start with the third apostle, James Zebedee, we might just dive right into the reading. And Crystalline, are you ready to read, or shall I jump in with the reading?
Sure, I can read if you'd like.
Why don't you do that?
All right. It's section 3 of paper 139 on James Zebedee. James, the older of the two apostle sons of Zebedee, whom Jesus nicknamed Sons of Thunder, was 30 years old when he became an apostle. He was married, had four children, and lived near his parents in the outskirts of Capernaum, Bethsaida. He was a fisherman, plying his calling in company with his younger brother John and in association with Andrew and Simon. James and his brother John enjoyed the advantage of having known Jesus longer than any of the other apostles. This able apostle was a temperamental contradiction. He seemed really to possess two natures, both of which were actuated by strong feelings. He was particularly vehement when his indignation was once fully aroused. He had a fiery temper when once it was adequately provoked, and when the storm was over, he was always wont to justify and excuse his anger under the pretense that it was wholly a manifestation of righteous indignation. Except for these periodic upheavals of wrath, James's personality was much like that of Andrew. He did not have Andrew's discretion or insight into human nature, but he was a much better public speaker. Next to Peter, unless it was Matthew, James was the best public orator among the 12. Though James was in no sense moody, he could be quiet and taciturn one day and a very good talker and storyteller the next. He usually talked freely with Jesus, but among the 12, for days at a time, he was the silent man. His one great weakness was these spells of unaccountable silence. The outstanding feature of James's personality was his ability to see all sides of a proposition. Of all the 12, he came the nearest to grasping the real import and significance of Jesus' teaching. He, too, was slow at first to comprehend the Master's meaning, but ere they had finished their training, he had acquired a superior concept of Jesus' message. James was able to understand a wide range of human nature. He got along well with the versatile Andrew, the impetuous Peter, and his self-contained brother John. Though James and John had their troubles trying to work together, it was inspiring to observe how well they got along. They did not succeed quite so well as Andrew and Peter, but they did much better than would ordinarily be expected of two brothers, especially such headstrong and determined brothers. But strange as it may seem, these two sons of Zebedee were much more tolerant of each other than they were of strangers. They had great affection for one another. They had always been happy playmates. It was these, quote, sons of thunder, unquote, who wanted to call fire down from heaven to destroy the Samaritans, presumed to show disrespect for their master. But the untimely death of James greatly modified the vehement temperament of his younger brother John. That characteristic of Jesus, which James most admired, was the master's sympathetic affection. Jesus' understanding interest in the small and the great, the rich and the poor, made a great appeal to him. James Zebedee was a well-balanced thinker and planner. Along with Andrew, he was one of the more level-headed of the apostolic group. He was a vigorous individual, but was never in a hurry. He was an excited balance wheel for Peter. He was an excellent balance wheel for Peter. He was modest and undramatic, a daily server, an unpretentious worker, seeing no special reward when he once grasped something of the real meaning of the kingdom. And even in the story about the mother of James and John, who asked that her sons be granted places on the right hand and the left hand of Jesus, it should be remembered that it was the mother who made this request. And when they signified that they were ready to assume such responsibilities, it should be recognized that they were cognizant of the dangers accompanying the master's supposed revolt against the Roman power, and they were also willing to pay the price. When Jesus asked if they were ready to drink the cup, they replied that they were. And as concerned James, it was literally true. He did drink the cup with the Master, seeing that he was the first of the apostles to experience martyrdom, being early put to death with the sword by Herod Agrippa. James was thus the first of the 12 to sacrifice his life upon the new battle line of the kingdom. Herod Agrippa feared James above all the other apostles. He was indeed often quiet and silent, but he was brave and determined when his convictions were aroused and challenged. James lived his life to the full, and when the end came, he bore himself with such grace and fortitude that even his accuser, an informer who attended his trial and execution, was so touched that he rushed away from the scene of James's death to join himself to the disciples of Jesus.
A fiery temper.
Yeah. Tell me something, Gigi. You don't mind if I call you Gigi, do you?
Please, love it.
Well, so when we read about James in the accounts in the Bible, and does any of that fiery temper come through in some of the depiction in the Bible?
Yeah, actually, they're both quite recognized for as outlined, the sons of thunder, and that sticks with both of them right through, although it becomes quite obvious that John mellows out. But James, by the way, from the biblical worldview, is called James the Greater, to distinguish him from James the son of Alphaeus, who is known as James the Lesser.
Right.
And James the Greater is the patron saint of Spain, and it's believed that James's bones and relics are buried in Spain. But yes, biblically, they recognize that he really had a short fuse, and this is probably what cost him his life with Herod Agrippa, in that he was constantly railing against Agrippa. And as with John the Baptist, you can't do that to the king without there being repercussions. As a result, I think biblically they put James's death in and around 44 AD. So he went early.
So around 34 AD, you said?
No, I'm sorry, 44
AD. No, I think you might have said that. I was just clarifying. Yeah. Well, that's pretty amazing. So that's really just 14 years from the time of the resurrection and the Master's ascension that he had on earth to do any preaching.
And in the Acts of the Apostles, I believe that it's indicated that he's executed by the sword, so he wasn't crucified.
Right. We just read that he was put to the sword.
Oh, yeah. Well, there we go. That's right. I had my brain off in the Bible. That's right. We just read it.
Okay, so just to clarify, the biblical account says he was also executed with the sword or with...
Yes, that's right. Biblically, the Christians and people with a biblical worldview understand that James was executed by the sword, not at the hands of Herod Agrippa, but by Herod Agrippa, in and around probably 44 AD, and primarily for his attitude, for James's attitude and his preaching against Agrippa and Agrippa's action. Agrippa was a tough character. He was a mean king. What was called a client king for the Roman Empire. So he collected taxes on behalf of the Romans. He represented really the Romans, and he was protected by the Romans as their client protector relationship. Basically, the Romans had a protection racket going all across the Eastern Mediterranean, and Palestine was one of the areas. Herod and his sons were clients of the Roman Empire. They threw one of the sons out, the Herod's son who inherited Judea. They threw him out and put Pontius Pilate in his place.
I see.
So the Agrippa's, the Herod kingdom was a brutal a brutal regime, right from father down into the sons.
Well,
yeah,
I find it interesting. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just saying that I find it interesting that while they called both James and John the sons of the sons of thunder, that they also describe him as having been one of the more level-headed of the apostolic group. You know, they say, you know, later that, you know, he was quite intense when his righteous indignation was triggered. But it also says he was level-headed, or one of the more level-headed ones in the group. I find that an interesting contradiction.
Yeah, contradictory of ideas, isn't it?
I just wondered what that might look like.
Well, one of the things that I'm trying to determine here, and maybe you can help us out, Gigi, is this idea of the Epistle of James, for one thing. The Epistle of James would have naturally been attributed was it attributed to James the Apostle or James the Brother?
James the brother of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In the early part, in Matthew, Mark, in the Gospels, when they're referring to James, the Gospels are usually referring to James Zebedee. But from the Acts of the Apostles on, they're generally referring to James, the brother of Jesus. He became the head of the Christian, well, they weren't Christians then, but of the Jesus movement after the death of Jesus. He became the head of the Jerusalem church, which then after 70 AD, when Jerusalem was destroyed, they moved to Pella, and James had been killed. James, the brother of Jesus, had been killed. So that's the two. We're really talking about three James: James the Greater, who's James Zebedee; James the Lesser, which is James Alpheus; and James, brother of Jesus. So the Epistle of James is generally considered to be from the hands of the brother of Jesus.
The head of the church at Jerusalem.
But who was at the time the head of the church, that's right.
Yeah, okay. Are there any writings extant that are attributed to James, the apostle?
No. No.
He wasn't around long enough to do any writing, I guess.
Yeah,
considering
that's
how late some of the apostles were writing.
Yeah, the earliest writer really was Matthew, even though the textual critics today have put Mark as the earliest writing. Matthew wrote down in and around 1940. I'm sorry, geez, I want to keep going to go to that 19. In and around 40 AD, as he was working his way through and around the area of Antioch, he was writing down the remembered experiences with Jesus. And later, that document traveled with his assistant, a man named Isidore, who fled Jerusalem in 70 AD with Matthew's documents and with Andrew's documents and a few other documents to Pella, where he wrote the book of Matthew. So Matthew was one of the earliest, but after that, it really fell to the hands of kind of the second generation, who then wrote from the stories, and there you have Luke. Mark and Peter wrote the book of Mark, or Mark primarily just wrote it down primarily from dictation from Peter. And so those are the earliest ones, but there isn't anything that's turned up as sort of the Gospel of James the Great, or even any of the others, really. There are some that now that are starting to turn up: the Gospel according to Thomas, the Gospel according to Judas, but these were written considerably after. They would have been third or fourth generation.
Okay. Interesting. So what else do we have is there a particular incident that makes you think of the character of James particular that we could relate to our listeners?
Well, I'll just say a few things and then I'll let it over to Kirsten. One of the things I think that it comes out that's very important is that James, John, and Peter were the three close apostles to Jesus. They were like his assistants, close assistants. Sometimes you might consider it even his guard. They went everywhere with him. So they were there at the Mount of Transfiguration. They were there
okay.
when he raised the Jairus' daughter. They were with him at the Garden of Gethsemane. While all of the other apostles were at more of a distance from each of those. James and John and Peter saw stuff that the other apostles didn't see. And John records much of that in his writings. So that's I think a significant piece of information in identifying who James was and where was he in that group of apostles.
Yeah. You know, I just came across this one early event with James, and it was the Jesus Discourse on Spiritual Unity, and it says, one of the most eventful of all the evening conferences at Amethyst was the session having to do with the discussion of spiritual unity. James Zebedee had asked, "Master, how shall we learn to see alike and thereby enjoy more harmony among ourselves?" That would indicate something about James as an early apostle, you know, before having been with Jesus for very much time. And this was when Jesus heard this question and answered, as he did with a number of the apostles on different occasions, by saying their name twice. James, James, when did I teach you that you should all see alike?
Yeah,
I've come into the world to proclaim spiritual liberty to the end that mortals may be empowered to live individual lives of originality and freedom before God. I do not desire that social harmony and fraternal peace shall be purchased by the sacrifice of free personality and spiritual originality. So what I require of you, my apostles, is spiritual unity. I won't go on, but that was a memorable response to James early and, you know, mildly mistaken and naive question to Jesus
mm-hmm.
concerning spiritual unity.
Had James lived a little bit longer and had he been able to write down more of his own experiences, one could almost have bet that he would have included that little vignette in his writing. As it is, we don't have that in the Bible. And what an important change that would have made to history if that had been included in one of the New Testament writings.
That's true.
Yeah.
Although Jesus said, a house divided amongst itself cannot stand. And that didn't help. That still didn't help.
Right. But it also didn't clarify his teaching about not expecting all of his followers to think the same way or to have the same theology, if you will. And that really has been the stumbling block of Christianity.
That's true.
This idea that, you know, if you disagree with the theology of the church, whichever faction of the church that you're participating in, that you are being disloyal or that you're in some cases booted out, or you know, that this is seen as a real sin instead of, you know, the creative free will process of identifying for yourself what are the most important parts of this message to you. And I think that that's a pretty critical difference or pretty critical element of Jesus' teaching. And because we read earlier in this section that James pretty much had a really strong grip of the master's teachings, at least towards the end, it's sad that he didn't have a chance to write that down.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, it is, because I think...
Well,
oh,
given
I think
what,
that when we...
What,
go ahead, Ann.
Well, I was just going to say quickly that given what we are told, they would be indicating that had James written something down, it would have contained more of what Jesus had intended to say than any of the other apostles, really.
Indeed.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, because I think Urantia book readers will probably have already gleaned this out, but James, Nathaniel seem to be the two who asked the most pertinent questions, and particularly Nathaniel. Nathaniel is kind of a philosopher, had a lot of philosophical questions that I think would, had they been written down, and the answers written that Jesus gave had been written down, I think Christianity would be very, very different right now.
Indeed. Yeah, that was really my point, that
exactly.
Of all of the things that Jesus said to James, that is one of the most memorable to Urantia book reader, because it so illustrates this idea of unity, not uniformity, that we all really love to recount. And what a different world we would live in. I mean, not just how different would Christianity be, but what kind of impact might that have had just on all of Western civilization? And I just find it profound.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
So I'm trying to get some more idea as to how we might get a little bit better idea of who James was. And one of the things that occurs to me is, maybe that's something we should go back and do with Andrew and Peter at some point if we get a chance, but just going forward, it strikes me that we learned something about the apostles, not only by finding out something on the front end, but possibly finding out something in terms of what Jesus is saying on the back end to his apostles. And so there is the place where Jesus is appearing to them in Galilee after his death and resurrection, and where he appears to all of the apostles and then walks with them two by two and giving them that instruction.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just thinking that maybe we could go there and possibly just read a little bit from what Jesus is saying to James as he's walking with him by the lake.
What paper
right.
is that?
What paper and what page number?
Yes, and that's where I was stalling just a little bit to go ahead and and get
I think it's
back.
Paper 193, isn't it?
It's Visiting with the Apostles 2 and 2 and 192, and it's Section 2. And it's just down a little ways.
It's
so
hard
he
when
walks
you're looking
with,
online
works,
as opposed...
Yeah, he walks with Andrew and then James after walking with Peter and John. And so 192, section 2, paragraph 7, or page 2048, paragraph 3 in the single column book. And so he starts out walking with Andrew and James, and he talks to Andrew first. But the next paragraph, the fourth paragraph down in the page, or paragraph 8 in the section, it says, "Then Jesus turned to James, asking, 'James, do you trust me?' And of course, James replied, 'Yes, Master, I trust you with all my heart.' Then said Jesus, 'James, if you trust me more, you will be less impatient with your brethren. If you will trust me, it will help you to be kind to the brotherhood of believers. Learn to weigh the consequences of your sayings and your doings. Remember that the reaping is in accordance with the sowing. Pray for tranquility of spirit and cultivate patience. These graces with living faith shall sustain you when the hour comes to drink the cup of sacrifice. But never be dismayed. When you are on earth, when you are through on earth, you shall also come to be with me." And go ahead.
No, go ahead. You finish your thought.
Well, I'm just thinking in terms of, you know, the patience, and, you know, he knew of his tendency to erupt in anger, and probably that vehemence is what cut his life short, which is why they allude to it in that reading. And I think we'll read a little bit more of that when we read about John here in just a minute. But mm-hmm. But the fact is that what cut James' life short also acted as a tonic to have John lead a rather long life. What was
That's
your point,
true.
Crystal?
That's right.
I've lost track of that thought, so I think
okay.
We could just go on with that. But one thing I wanted to say is I agree with you that I think it would behoove us to look at these two papers connectedly as we go forward with this study, and maybe
yeah.
even do go back and look at what he had to say to Andrew and Peter.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, should we look at Andrew and Peter right now before we go on to John?
I think so.
Okay,
What do you think, Gigi?
Yeah, that's a great idea. I think that this tells us a lot, as we know that this is the last words that Jesus is going to be able to say to his apostles, and so he's focusing on a particular point to that individual, and here he's saying, you know, patience. If you trust me, you'll be less impatient with your brethren. So just remember, pray for tranquility of spirit and cultivate patience. So he's really saying to James, you got to get more patience, my man, and that's it. So that tells us a great deal about James, and I think you're right. I think if we do the same, it'll tell us a lot more about Peter and Andrew.
I think many of us have imagined what the Master would have to say to us.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, exactly.
How he would, I mean, he just was so masterful, of course, at identifying what the shortcomings were of his fellows without making them feel in the least bit put down. And I think that one of the things that's really fascinating about this section is the way he broaches the topic with these men. You know, the fact that he starts out by asking, you know, like if we were to go back to Peter, well, I guess he started with John, but he asked the same question of Peter. Peter, do you love me? If you love me, Peter, feed my lambs. You know, if you love me, John, then give up your intolerance, you know. Do you trust me, James? Then, you know, trust your fellows more. You know, it's just he has a way of bringing this up, bringing up their shortcomings in a way that just makes them feel called to do better as opposed to being reprimanded.
Yeah.
It's interesting, just a biblical point here. The Gospel of John is called the Gospel of Love, the Love Gospel.
Right.
And here, these are Jesus' last words to John. Devote your life to proving that love is the greatest thing in the world. It is the love of God that impels man to seek salvation. Love is the ancestor of all spiritual goodness, the essence of the true and the beautiful. So John
took him very seriously about that admonition.
That's right. John took it to heed.
Yeah.
And I'm sure all of them did. I'm sure all of them found those last words of Jesus to be really, really moving.
Mm-hmm. Well, so did we read that paragraph completely for Peter? I mean, we just alluded to it. Do we want to read Andrew, or do we want to read?
Let's start with. I think we should just go down the line. Maybe we should do John first and then go back and read this section since he starts with John.
Okay, so let's...
That's a good idea.
What do you think, Gigi?
Yep, I think you're right. I think that we should pick up John Zebedee, outline as much as paper 139 will give us, and then go back to 192. I think that's a great idea.
Okay, let's do that.
Why don't one of you read on John?
I'm sorry that I'm not able to just do that. My glasses and my eyes just aren't working the same since I got this clunk on the head.
No problem.
Okay.
I'll be glad to read. John Zebedee. Again, we're on page 1553 now, or section 4 of paper 139 on the 12 apostles. When he became an apostle, John was 24 years old and was the youngest of the 12. He was unmarried and lived with his parents at Bethsaida. He was a fisherman and worked with his brother James in partnership with Andrew and Peter. Both before and after becoming an apostle, John functioned as the personal agent of Jesus in dealing with the Master's family. And he continued to bear this responsibility as long as Mary, the mother of Jesus, lived. Since John was the youngest of the 12 and so closely associated with Jesus in his family affairs, he was very dear to the Master. But it cannot be truthfully said that he was the disciple whom Jesus loved. You would hardly suspect such a magnanimous personality as Jesus to be guilty of showing favoritism, of loving one of his apostles more than the others. The fact that John was one of the three personal aides of Jesus lent further color to this mistaken idea, not to mention that John, along with his brother James, had known Jesus longer than the others. Peter, James, and John were assigned as personal aides to Jesus soon after they became apostles. Shortly after the selection of the 12, and at the time Jesus appointed Andrew to act as director of the group, he said to him, "And now I desire that you assign two or three of your associates to be with me, to remain by my side, to comfort me and to minister to my daily needs. And Andrew thought best to select for this special duty the next three first chosen apostles. He would have liked to volunteer for such a blessed service himself, but the Master had already given him his commission. So he immediately directed that Peter, James, and John attach themselves to Jesus. John Zebedee had many lovely traits of character, but one which was not so lovely was his inordinate but usually well-concealed conceit. His long association with Jesus made many and great changes in his character. This conceit was greatly lessened, but after growing old and becoming more or less childish, this self-esteem reappeared to a certain extent, so that when engaged in directing Nathan in the writing of the gospel which now bears his name, the aged apostle did not hesitate repeatedly to refer to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. In view of the fact that John came nearer to being the chum of Jesus than any other earth mortal, that he was his chosen personal representative in so many matters, it is not strange that he should have come to regard himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved, since he most certainly knew he was the disciple whom Jesus so frequently trusted. The strongest trait in John's character was his dependability. He was prompt and courageous, faithful and devoted. His greatest weakness was this characteristic conceit. He was the youngest member of his father's family and the youngest of the apostolic group. Perhaps he was just a bit spoiled. Maybe he had been humored slightly too much. But the John of after years was a very different type of person than the self-admiring and arbitrary young man who joined the ranks of Jesus' apostles when he was 24. Those characteristics of Jesus which John most appreciated were the Master's love and unselfishness. These traits made such an impression on him that his whole subsequent life became dominated by the sentiment of love and brotherly devotion. He talked about love and wrote about love. This son of thunder became the apostle of love. And at Ephesus, when the aged bishop was no longer able to stand in the pulpit and preach, but had to be carried to church in a chair, and when at the close of the service he was asked to say a few words to the believers, for years his only utterance was, "My little children, love one another." John was a man of few words except when his temper was aroused. He thought much but said little. As he grew older, his temper became more subdued, better controlled. But he never overcame his disinclination to talk. He never fully mastered this reticence. But he was gifted with a remarkable and creative imagination. There was another side to John that one would not expect to find in this quiet and introspective type. He was somewhat bigoted and inordinately intolerant. In this respect, he and James were very much alike. They both wanted to call down fire from heaven on the heads of the disrespectful Samaritans. When John encountered some strangers teaching in Jesus' name, he promptly forbade them. But he was not the only one of the 12 who was tainted with this kind of self-esteem and superiority consciousness. John's life was tremendously influenced by the sight of Jesus going about without a home, as he knew how faithfully he had made provision for the care of his mother and family. John also deeply sympathized with Jesus because of his family's failure to understand him, being aware that they were gradually withdrawing from him. this entire situation, together with Jesus ever deferring his slightest wish to the will of the Father in heaven, and his daily life of implicit trust, made such a profound impression on John that it produced marked and permanent changes in his character, changes which manifested themselves throughout his entire subsequent life. John had a cool and daring courage which few of the other apostles possessed. He was the one apostle who followed right along with Jesus the night of his arrest and dared to accompany his master into the very jaws of death. He was present and near at hand right up to the last earthly hour and was found faithfully carrying out his trust with regard to Jesus' mother and ready to receive such additional instructions as might be given during the last moments of the master's mortal existence. One thing is certain. John was thoroughly dependable. John usually sat on Jesus' right hand when the 12 were at meat. He was the first of the 12 really and fully to believe in the resurrection, and he was the first to recognize the master when he came to them on the seashore after his resurrection. This son of Zebedee was very closely associated with Peter in the early activities of the Christian movement, becoming one of the chief supporters of the Jerusalem church. He was the right-hand support of Peter on the day of Pentecost. Several years after the martyrdom of James, John married his brother's widow. The last 20 years of his life, he was cared for by a loving granddaughter. John was in prison several times and was banished to the Isle of Patmos for a period of 4 years until another emperor came to power in Rome. Had not John been tactful and sagacious, he would undoubtedly have been killed, as was his more outspoken brother James. As the years passed, John, together with James, the Lord's brother, learned to practice wise conciliation when they appeared before the civil magistrates. They found that a soft answer turns away wrath. They also learned to represent the church as a spiritual brotherhood devoted to the social service of mankind, rather than as the kingdom of heaven. They taught loving service rather than ruling power, kingdom and king. When in temporary exile on Patmos, John wrote the book of Revelation, which you now have in greatly abridged and distorted form. This book of Revelation contains the surviving fragments of a great revelation, large portions of which were lost, other portions of which were removed subsequent to John's writing. It is preserved in only fragmentary and adulterated form. John traveled much, labored incessantly, and after becoming bishop of the Asian churches, settled down at Ephesus. He directed his associate Nathan in the writing of the so-called Gospel According to John at Ephesus when he was 99 years old. Of all the 12 apostles, John Zebedee eventually became the outstanding theologian. He died a natural death at Ephesus in A.D. 103 when he was 101 years of age.
Wow. What a life.
Lived a ripe old existence.
Yeah,
what a life.
And what an interesting combination of cool and daring courage. You know, he was cool enough to, you know, figure out how to find a soft answer to turn away the wrath. and cool enough to come up with the idea that it was a spiritual brotherhood. I mean, that line right there, that spiritual brotherhood devoted to the social service of mankind, is brilliant.
Yeah.
Rather than continuing to call it the kingdom of heaven, even though that's what Jesus referred to it as.
Well, and Jesus only did so, we're informed over and over, because it was far too advanced for them to think in terms of the family of God. They just couldn't conceive of a God that would have a family, which is pretty amazing to think of from this standpoint in time, even though there are many people that on earth that have that same kind of consciousness. It should be, you know, something we ought to reflect on from time to time, that somehow it has finally evolved in our culture, that it is possible for many, many people to really recognize God as a father and as a loving father in the way that Jesus actually meant for us to recognize him as really the father of a large family, and as all of us as family members, brothers and sisters in that family.
Mm-hmm.
And just to think of how easily some of us who've had the revelation for a while accept that, and then to consider how much of a hurdle that still is for so much of the world to consider that. And yet there may be larger and larger numbers that are willing to hear that that saving truth. But John was able to bring that about and use that, at least to some extent, in his focus on the love of God and the love of the Lord Jesus Christ.
When you think about our culture, just the development of our culture in the last 50 years, maybe more so if you look at the last 100, but even in my lifetime, you see the difference in the way different generations have different expectations of what the word father means. It's only been very recently that we've even started to evaluate parental training or parental qualities. As a, you know, just in North American culture, I don't know what I can say about that in relationship to other parts of the world. But I know that the difference between my grandfather or my father's generation and the current generation, there's really a huge difference in what's expected of father. And I think we're moving more towards a culture that respects and values the input, the impact of fathers on the health of raising children. You know, we had Claire Thurston on just a few weeks ago talking about her new book on the importance of fathers in the family structure, in child rearing. And I think that this is all going to have a great impact on how Christianity sees the fatherhood of God.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there that next generation coming about, what is being called, you know, millennials and, you know, Generation Y seem to have more of an emphasis on fathers having an equal role with the mother than generations two generations ago, or even one generation ago. I'm not sure that even Gen X's are as well known, but that seems to be a growing evolution in the culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if it's taken more than 2,000 years after his teachings to really even begin to grasp the importance of fathers in family, in the child rearing portion of parental experience. It's not surprising that the whole world would have had an issue with this idea of father, the fatherhood of God, or the family of God, in the same way that Jesus would have seen it, or would have meant it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that the use of the term the kingdom of heaven, kingdom of God, became quite a problem for the Roman Empire. And if I can just go back for one second on part of this reading, in the paragraph there on that spiritual brotherhood devoted to the social service of mankind, just a sentence ahead there, it said, as the years passed by, John, together with James, the Lord's brother, so Jesus' brother, learned to practice wise conciliation when they appeared before the civil magistrates. So they're always getting called up before the authorities and brought into the courts all over the Eastern Mediterranean. They found that a soft answer turns away wrath. They also learned to represent the church as the spiritual brotherhood devoted to the social service of mankind, rather than as the kingdom of heaven. And I am of the opinion, and many, many scholars and others who research this, was that had they actually adopted that sentence rather than the kingdom, they probably wouldn't have had as much in the way of persecutions in the second century. Part of the reason for those persecutions was the use of the word kingdom, and in Rome, that meant politics, and that meant death. That meant that they were happy. They were fine with people's religion. They were fine with people's religious alliances. But if it looked like there was going to be any kind of competition to the political state, that was a problem. And that was
right.
Where much of the persecutions came by. So had they adopted John and James's, Jesus' brother, representing the church as the spiritual brotherhood devoted to the social service of humankind, it may have gone better for Christianity in the early years.
And throughout history.
And throughout history, right, and beyond.
Yes, to infinity and beyond. Well, you know, that's such a really crucial part of the, like, as we were just discussing before, the, you know, if James had lived long enough to record what Jesus's admonition was to him in the final hours, and mm-hmm. if this concept of Jesus's brother James and John would have made it into a major part of Christian theology.
Mm-hmm.
There are just so many places that we can see where the, you know, just the immaturity and problem magnets that we human beings tend to be
mm-hmm.
just take things off kilter time and time again. Not just
yeah.
we humans, but even Adam and Eve and even the prince's staff. I mean, there's so much error when you look back at the history of revelation on our world. And yet, it seems to be the way. You know,
yeah.
we learn the hard, maybe we just learn best the hard way and the long way.
It seems so. It's human stubbornness.
Maybe those lessons are best learned by some of those intense experiences as well. After all, in much of the universe, the intensity of these kinds of experiences is muted by the fact that most worlds, the vast, vast majority of planets in the universes have never known wide-scale planetary, let alone system rebellion. This is a rare, rare thing to happen. What we grow up with as normal here on this planet, this idea of being cut off from any sense of identity with the rest of the universe, but you know, which is experienced, you know, by primitive man on all worlds to some extent, but still, the idea that we grow up with the kinds of things that we grow up with as normal, the attitudes, you know, the idea of, you know, how rampant selfishness is, how rampant trampling on the free will of other people, whether it's a young kid doing it as a bully or whether it's a wicked despot doing it over his entire nation. This planet has known horrific things that are regarded as normal or things to be expected anyway. And when you regard something as to be expected, aren't you regarding it as somewhat normal?
Yeah.
So
we grew up. This is our normal perspective.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I definitely grew up with bullies in the neighborhood. I grew up with all manner of, you know, kids taking advantage of other kids. You know, things that just wouldn't happen where there was a moral, let alone a spiritual formation occurring in families of all youth. I mean, I try to imagine what might have obtained in the Roman Catholic schools that I grew up in, if in fact, you know, the height of Roman Catholicism, just Roman Catholicism, would have been practiced as it was being preached from the pulpit in the mm-hmm. various families, if it actually had transferred to that, because the kinds of things that occurred in Catholic school, I know as my younger mind could not reconcile what I was experiencing in the schoolyard with what I was hearing from the pulpit on Sundays, and I had the kind of mind that I wanted to reconcile that. I thought that what was being said from the pulpit must have some kind of impact. And when I saw that Catholic school seemed to be worse than the public school that I went to for my kindergarten, for my one year in public school until I returned to public school in 12th grade, my goodness gracious, you know, I thought, what is so superior about Catholic school other than it seems to be strict and disciplined and, you know, inside, but on the schoolyard, all manner of chaos obtained.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I mean, in my experience or from my perspective, I think those two go hand in hand, that the reason it was more divided and there were more bullies, there was more aggression, was because of the profound repression that existed within the walls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So much overt morality being preached, and so little emphasis. I mean, the emphasis was there on spirituality. I can't say it wasn't there in the Catholic Church. It was there, but unless you're getting it from the home too. It's in the home where you learn that to be spiritual, I mean, from a young age, has a value. And you're not going to turn to a real, genuine, heartfelt spirituality unless you're impressed with the fact that at least one of your parents does so, and you see that as a value, in my opinion.
I also think that there's the issue of the focus of love. At least it is my belief that the focus in Catholicism is less on love and more on obedience. It's less mm-hmm. on the love of God than it is the fear or the retribution of God. And that those things seem to work strangely in the human mind.
Mm-hmm.
That the confusion of those two seemingly disparate concepts, I think, cause a great deal of mental and psychic confusion. I don't think that we would see the kinds of abuses that we have seen illustrated in the Catholic Church at large if the focus wasn't so much on the negative side of religion.
Yeah, well, I think that had these apostles that we're talking about today, had these apostles recorded more of Jesus' teachings and recorded it earlier when it was fresher in their mind, and had those been able to leak out just as what we do have did, leak out into the testaments and into the texts that served as a foundation for the religious institutions, or better yet, the value systems that came before us, then perhaps and probably whatever came, let's call it the Catholic Church, but I think the Church would have had a more positive basis or a more positive collection of ammunition order to deal with human depravity. I mean, the old saying that if you cannot control yourself, you will be controlled. It has been kind of a prevalent social policy ever since tribalism. Lock up the crazies and the bad guys and the maniacs, and that just filtered into when a church starts becoming the authority in running a society, then they revert back to the techniques of the world, from the world of magic and tribalism. But had more of Jesus' teachings been available, such as the unity versus uniformity and some of these ideas, of course, I mean, the one idea that I really abhorred got into the New Testament is, I didn't come to bring peace, I came to bring the sword statement.
Has
just created all kinds of havoc.
Yeah.
I mean, but of course, it's understandable that the apostles were sure that Jesus was coming back any minute, so why bother writing anything down, because he's going to be here right away. And in any case, he never wrote anything down, so maybe we shouldn't either.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, the fourth, this is what emerged out of the fourth phase of revealed religion to our planet, and now here we are with the fifth. What should we do? I think that these should be strong lessons to us.
And mm-hmm. I think that just the fact that we needed a fifth, the fact that this is really kind of an experimental process of revelation to begin with. This is the fifth epical revelation is also out of the norm for planetary revelation. That this is almost an experimental type of thing that is not the way revelation normally comes to a world. This is sort of in and of itself is an emergency mission.
Yeah, it's here because we have a philosophical crisis. And partly because of what I've already just said, is we didn't have enough of
because of the distorted teachings.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
not only do we have a philosophical crisis, but we have a philosophical crisis that could not be resolved by the visitation of a divine son.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Now that's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
You know, we have an issue where the last divine son was put on the cross. It is clear that today a divine son would also be sent to his death, dispatched pretty quickly, one way or the other. There just is not room. We know that plenty of prophets have been dispatched since that time. And, I mean, the Baha'is will point to the fact that Baha'u'llah, you know, Baha'u'llah died a natural death, but the Bab, the forerunner of him, who they regard as essentially Baha'u'llah's John the Baptist, was shot to death, you know, along with many supporters. And,
to say the same about Gandhi and Martin Luther King,
right?
We shoot our prophets. That's
yes.
we kill our prophets.
It's not a good neighborhood.
Right.
It's a tough place to be a prophet. That's for sure.
So given the impact that written words have had on our planet. The idea that they should think to leave us with written words that they declare from the outset within them are not sacred, but are revelation, is an interesting conundrum for us to wrestle with in making decisions about how to pay attention to these and how to live them and how to implement them.
It seems rather brilliant to me in that reading a book is an individual experience, and so this is one way that the sort of the spiritual, that those on the other side of the spiritual curtain can speak directly to the individual as you're reading, as you're reading these ideas, and these are incredibly powerful ideas that set your mind on fire. So the fifth phase of revealed religion coming this way, I can understand why the previous phases of revealed religion had to come through a being or a one-on-one teacher, because the majority of the people were illiterate. But now that the level of education has evolved on the planet so that many, if not most, are able to read and is presented then in reading material, just seems like a pretty brilliant concept.
Well, and considering what's happened in the past, there might have been a few less volunteers to come down here in person.
Yeah.
And you know, and given the real violence of our history and of our approach to religion as an entire civilization, I can just imagine sort of the kinds of counsel that would have been taking place prior to this revelation about what are we going to do? What are we going to do about your rancho? Like, anybody have any ideas here?
What's going to work here?
What could possibly get through this sort of stubborn, you know, belligerent sort of people? Would anybody have any thoughts here?
Send a book that each individual can determine and digest at their own speed, their own time, their own level of enlightenment. And in many ways, those of us who read this book are almost like apostles to the fifth epical revelation, the same way that what we're reading and studying about apostles to the fourth phase of revealed religion, that I mean, those of us who stand up and do something and decide that, look, this is an important document and we need to help it, makes us apostles, or at least disciples, in the sense that this is an important document that needs help from this side of the spiritual curtain.
You know, you make a very, very important point, and I just had this conversation with a fellow reader believer of the Urantia book not an hour ago, and I posed the question. I said, you know, after all, you know, growing up, do you remember ever praying that, gosh, you know, I wish I could have been an apostle? You know, just falling in love with the idea of the 12 apostles and realizing that they got to have that experience of being with Jesus and somehow, you know, we missed out. I know not everybody thinks that way, but I know that a lot of people did, and there were a lot of unuttered aspirations in a lot of us that found the revelation. So, brother, I do believe you speak the truth. This is an opportunity for anybody who finds the truth in the Urantia book, really, to take up at least, as you say, discipleship. But I would venture to say that perhaps there is a way in which we each do become apostles. At least I know many people that regard themselves as living ministers, and in that sense may indeed be apostles. And in this generation, it's not limited to men.
prayer of Elijah when asked, who shall I send? The great prayer that came from Elijah was, here I am, Lord, send me. Call me.
Yes.
So who is it?
I would say that I would be worthy to be some
right
considered that. I don't think I am. I don't think many people who believe they are really quite prepared.
But I think that's the humility that's needed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think having just read about John and his, you know,
conceit.
Yes, actually, I didn't want to come out and say that. But yeah, indeed. I think that Urantia book readers have plenty of those tendencies without our fanning those flames, so to speak. I think one of the reasons why it seemed appropriate to so many who followed Jesus or who followed any prophets to fall into this idea of being chosen people or in some way being special,
mm-hmm,
is a little bit dangerous, a little bit fraught with danger.
It's not a little bit dangerous, it's terribly dangerous. And you bring
out an excellent
point, Crystalline. And I couldn't underscore that point more. I think the point that Gumshoe was making here is a little bit different. But
yeah,
let's stick with your point for a second. Really, your point is the point that assuming apostleship, okay, assuming apostleship on one's part is not what we're called to do.
Right.
However, what I heard in Gumshoe's comment was aspiring to apostleship.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. And I certainly have shared those feelings of wishing I had been there, wishing I could have been part of that original women's corps, wishing I would have been able to have sat at his feet.
Mm-hmm.
Just that the power of the emotion that come from wanting to serve that master,
yes,
our master, really having that unquenchable desire to be of service. And how differently that feels when that is motivated by love. Love of him, love of his value, the values he taught, love of the person, the personality that he exhibited, love of so much of the message that he was here to reveal. You can't help but feel a bit inflamed with that. But I also know that this idea of being an apostle or being part of that inner circle is also fraught with danger, and one that shouldn't be taken lightly. And
yeah.
even today, I think I'm moved again by saying that John had this cool and daring courage. The cool part of that, you rarely ever see that, those two things juxtaposed in that way. And, mm-hmm. you know, later it said, you know, he was sagacious as well as tactful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, had we been at the master's feet being trained by him for 3 years, we may have more, we may exhibit more of those traits within our own communities, within our own movement. But I have to admit that I tend to see far more of the conceit and the presumption illustrated in my friends and fellows and myself.
Sure.
Then I do that sagacious tact and coolness.
Well, you know, you're bringing up some excellent points, and you know what's striking me as you're talking about this is why we're doing this study at all. You know, why are we studying these 12 apostles? And some of the reason we're studying is just, it's fascinating just to study who these individuals were. They happen to all be men, and I think at some point we ought to undertake to study the women of the women's corps, and that might be upcoming as well. That'll take a lot more doing, actually.
I was going to say, if we could.
Yeah, but I think we can probably undertake to do some of that. It's going to take much more scholarship in order to actually know something more about them. But the point here being, there are so many levels to understand this on, and we actually touched on something that you know, kind of escaped me at the beginning and isn't escaping me now, and that is that there is that inspiration, and you know, it took me a while to remember that, you know, when I was younger, I did have those feelings. You know, I did have those feelings about, you know, the apostles. I did want to know more about who they were. There were all kinds of uttered and unuttered prayers that went up that the angels heard. And, you know, somehow I very fortunately got a hold of the Urantia Revelation, which addressed many of those questions, many of those things that I wanted to know as a youth that would be spiritually inspiring to me. And part of what this study of the apostles is doing, you know, from a bottom-up perspective, it's definitely disabusing us of, in the first place, growing up Catholic, of this idea of these 12 men that were nothing but saints that we can only approach through, they listened to the master and they asked him some dumb questions, but ultimately they followed him and they did the right thing and they became saints. And you know, I, for the life of me, as a young Catholic boy, wondered, God, how come everybody back then got to be saints, and how the heck will I ever? It seems like a damn steep ladder to climb to ever get there. and it looks like I'm never going to get there, and I'll be lucky to get to purgatory and just burn out my sins there a little while and eventually be accepted into heaven. You know, what a sorry, bloody, you know, way to look at how you're going to get to God. And, of course, you know, I rejected that at some point, and eventually, you know, for me, luckily found the Urantia book early, you know, before I entered.
Well, I have to say that I'm not to sound conceited. But I'm really
okay,
glad
it's a
that
second generation thing coming. I can hear it. I can feel it.
No, I'm glad that I didn't grow up with this idea of saints. And
yeah.
Having that, you know, sort of held over my head, I would have failed miserably I frankly never even thought of nor wished to be one. And
right.
I'm glad that I didn't have that set up as a as a marker.
Right. So to maybe put closure on that on that kind of thinking, you know, and you mentioned this idea of the danger and the idea of the apostleship business of the fifth epical revelation becoming a chosen people kind of thing, idea, and I agree with you, that's an awful idea. But what I heard in Gumshoe's pronouncement there, and I really take it to heart, Gumshoe, I think it's brilliant. This is open to anyone who wants to really love and follow the revelation, and it's not a matter of you know, I have all kinds of rights surrounding that. It's more a matter of I have all these privileges of service surrounding that. I have new opportunities in life surrounding that. And that,
yeah.
to me, is really the crux of what I heard in what Gumshoe was saying. You know, the idea is that this will not be an apostleship of 12 or 144,000. Or, you know, some other limited number that, okay,
sure.
At some point, okay, we're closed now. All right, sorry, no more room.
We have all the saints we need. Move
no.
along.
you now I get think, the second I, tier places.
I think
no.
when, what I was sort of alluding to was that sometime about 40 years ago when this first came to me, and I talked to a Urantia book reader, and he was saying, this is the fifth epical revelation. And I said, what does that mean? He says, it means it's important. He said, I don't want to show up in heaven and then say, so you were given the fifth epical revelation, what did you do with it? And I'm going,
right.
Nothing. I think that if this book has come into your hands, it's for a reason. Maybe it's just there to tease you. Maybe it's there to enlighten you. But it's also there to call you to a higher understanding of what's possible. And because it came to you, every person on this planet is unique, and every person has a gift. You're good at something. Something you're good at. There's something that you love and that you're good at, and that it will help to expand what this is saying. We don't have to quote
Absolutely.
The book. We don't have to, it's just a book. It's not the word of God. It's just a book. But the ideas in it are profound. And the ideas in there can change each and every individual who spend some time with it and help to recognize how we got here and how that is part of the plan to where we're going. And
yeah,
I'm
absolutely.
This little spot in the middle here that I can make some kind of a contribution to make this world at this time a little bit better. One person at a time or bigger, whatever it is, I can make I can make a difference. And so here I am, Lord, call me or send me. The prayer
use
of Elijah.
Me.
Use
what
me.
What you have me do? Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I certainly, I hope you know, Gumshoe, that I certainly didn't mean that to in any way imply that you were being conceited
no,
or that you were taking any liberties, because I fully agree with you.
No, I'm a low-maintenance guy. No, don't worry about that stuff. I'm a low-maintenance guy.
But, I mean, I also fully agree with you. And, you know, to completely backstep a little, you know, I do think that this book is nothing if it's not an example of the fact that it was just regular folks mm-hmm. who became the apostles.
Yeah, that's right.
They weren't mm-hmm. They weren't special, particularly educated or particularly sophisticated sorts of folk. They were just regular fishermen guys. I mean, they weren't.
Yeah.
And the fact that Jesus, not only did Jesus choose them, but he allowed them to choose each other.
That's right.
I mean, it's a masterful treatise on leadership. And trying to make just normal folks feel like they were that they were chosen to be part of this spiritual brotherhood and this spiritual kingdom. So, you know, on the one hand, I'm sort of admonishing us to not get too big-headed. On the other hand, I'm saying do everything you possibly can to use those special gifts, as you were just saying.
Right.
Now, if I
don't
can,
arrogate
I also
to yourself, to... don't arrogate to yourself the rights of apostleship. Humbly accept the service of being an apostle. What does it mean? You know, he who would be greatest among you, let him be server of all, is what Jesus exhorted us to follow.
Indeed.
And that's what he exhorted his apostles to do. If you would be ambassadors of the kingdom, then, you know, serve as I have served you. Go ahead.
And on that note,
I just wanted to say one more
sure.
point. On, I just wanted to go back a few steps on the women's corps, and you suggested that that we should do that. And I just wanted to blatantly promote my program, which is going to be tomorrow. Tomorrow on the Sunday version of Cosmic Citizen, God's Gumshoe is doing an investigation of the New Testament, and right now we've been investigating the apostles, and about three episodes back we did an investigation on the women's corps that your listeners may find helpful, so they can go back
wonderful
and we did that from the biblical perspective, from the scholarly perspective, and from the Urantia Papers perspective. That's how we've built that program, is that we're looking at the New Testament Bible from through three witnesses or three voices, those who have a biblical perspective, a worldview, those who have an academic, the theologians, philosophers, what is it that they say the Bible is in these situations, and what does the Urantia Papers say about it, and the thing that I really, really liked probably more than anything was in the picking of the apostles, Jesus picked six of his friends, well, five of his friendly people that he knew, friends and mostly acquaintances, and then one, Nathaniel, that wasn't exactly his friend. Then he let them go and pick six more. But in the women's corps, he stood up one day and declared to his apostles that we're going to bring 12 women into the women's corps. And the shock and the reverberation mm-hmm. of that rippled out through for quite some time. And then how that completely turned around and how they saw the wisdom of that when they went into the towns that had houses of ill repute that men could not go into, and how the women's corps went in, and how the women's mm-hmm. corps tended to, and helped to help and the sick and the afflicted. It's a tremendous story, and it's I hope that on the Saturday program we do get to go a little deeper in it. But in any case, we have done that on the Sunday program for the listeners who would like to produce it. It's in the archive. You can go.
Well, thank you, thank you so much, because that would be an invaluable resource to continuing this, delving into this topic.
Yeah,
and we are down to our last. Go ahead.
No, well, yeah, why don't you just post that URL, and yes, we are down to our last 14 minutes now, and we probably ought to move on to Philip, if we can.
Well, I was going to suggest that rather than going on to Philip, that we go back to the paper at the end and
192,
and finish
yeah.
reading those two, because we really don't have time to start on Philip.
Okay.
And we will just have time to do the other.
Well, why don't you then read through those for us, if you would. Have you got that up and handy?
I do.
Okay.
Well,
so
I'm just going to start at the beginning of that section and then read through James and
May
John.
May as well. Yeah.
This is from paper 192, section 2, beginning with paragraph 1. Visiting with the Apostles 2 and 2. When they had finished breakfast and while the others sat by the fire, Jesus beckoned to Peter and to John that they should come with him for a stroll on the beach. As they walked along, Jesus said to John, "John, do you love me?" And when John answered, "Yes, Master, with all my heart," the Master said, "Then, John, give up your intolerance and learn to love men as I have loved you. Devote your life to proving that love is the greatest thing in the world. It is the love of God that impels men to seek salvation. Love is the ancestor of all spiritual goodness, the essence of the true and the beautiful." Jesus then turned toward Peter and asked, "Peter, do you love me?" And Peter answered, "Lord, you know I love you with all my soul." Then said Jesus, "If you love me, Peter, feed my lambs. Do not neglect to minister to the weak, the poor, and the young. Preach the gospel without fear or favor. Remember always that God is no respecter of persons. Serve your fellow men even as I have served you. Forgive your fellow mortals even as I have forgiven you. Let experience teach you the value of meditation and the power of intelligent reflection." After they had walked along a little farther, the Master turned to Peter and asked, "Peter, do you really love me?" And then said Simon, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And again said Jesus, "Then take good care of my sheep. Be a good and a true shepherd to the flock. Betray not their confidence in you. Be not taken by surprise at the enemy's hand. Be on guard at all times. Watch and pray." When they had gone a few steps farther, Jesus turned to Peter for the third time and asked, "Peter, do you truly love me?" And then Peter, being slightly grieved at the Master's seeming distrust of him, said with considerable feeling, "Lord, you know all things." Excuse me a second. "And therefore do you know that I really and truly love you?" Then said Jesus, "Feed my sheep. Do not forsake the flock. Be an example and an inspiration to all your fellow shepherds. Love the flock as I have loved you, and devote yourself to their welfare, even as I have devoted my life to your welfare, and follow after me even to the end." Can you take over reading for me,
Yes,
Andre?
I can. Peter took this last statement literally. that he should continue to follow after him. And turning to Jesus, he pointed to John, asking, "If I follow on after you, what shall this man do?" And then, perceiving that Peter had misunderstood his words, Jesus said, "Peter, be not concerned about what your brethren shall do. If I will that John should tarry after you are gone, even until I come back, what is that to you? Only make sure that you follow me." This remark spread among the brethren and was received as a statement by Jesus to the effect that John would not die before the Master returned, as many thought and hoped, to establish the kingdom in power and glory. It was this interpretation of what Jesus said that had much to do with getting Simon Zelotes back into service and keeping him at work. When they returned to the others, Jesus went for a walk and talk with Andrew and James. When they had gone a short distance, Jesus said to Andrew, "Andrew, do you trust me?" And when the former chief of the apostles heard Jesus ask such a question, he stood still and answered, "Yes, Master, of a certainty I trust you, and you know that I do." Then said Jesus, "Andrew, if you trust me, trust your brethren more, even Peter. I once trusted you with the leadership of your brethren. Now must you trust others as I leave you to go to the Father. When your brethren begin to scatter abroad because of bitter persecutions, be a considerate and wise counselor to James, my brother in the flesh, when they put heavy burdens upon him, which he is not qualified by experience to bear. And then go on trusting, for I will not fail you. When you are through on earth, you shall come to me." And we've read that part on James before.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's just wonderful what he says to Andrew.
There's so much in there.
Well, there is. And the idea, you know, he's putting a premium on experience as well. He knows his brother. His brother has been with him. You know, he educated his brother. You know, this was his right-hand man in the family, you know, once his father was gone. And yet he says to Andrew, who has now had the experience of leading the apostles, how important it is for him to help his brother in the flesh, who he foresees is going to be the head of the Jerusalem church. And not only foresees, but it's clear by some things said in the Urantia book that he probably, when he spoke intimately with James in some of his appearances, or in at least one of his appearances, I don't want to conflate anything, that clearly he must have been asking or suggesting that James go forward and be a part of...
And join the apostles.
And join the apostles and go forward and do some of that he would be qualified by ability and aptitude, if not by experience. And,
and obviously a lot of people would look at him as being qualified merely by relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the other things I want to interrupt here and say that I'm very moved by the fact that we know that his family was really hurt, that they were not allowed to be part of that apostolic core. And to realize also that Jesus was their father brother. The affection that he would have had for his biological kin would have been quite profound. And how... You know, imagine you know, just the sort of the conceit of John saying, I'm the one who Jesus loved. Imagine if his siblings had been permitted to be part of that core, how much strife that could have caused within the 12. You know, mm-hmm. it really is wise that he didn't have them with him during that period of time. Don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I think everything he did had such a wisdom and such a precision. And even the setup before he got here, he just, I mean, the fact that he was born in Bethlehem, as the Old Testament had prophesied, I mean, everything he did was for a purpose. There wasn't the slightest, minutest detail that didn't have a purpose. And the fact that he left his family out of the apostolic program, while it hurt them very much and it caused some distance between them, it was absolutely the right thing to do, because the apostles took the brunt of the persecutions and the difficulty of bringing these new raw ideas forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a brilliant move, but it caused a lot of family dissension.
Well, and there's also the element, without, you know, in our last 4 minutes deviating too much on this, we might talk on this in a subsequent week, but a lot of the problems in subsequent, you know, the early formation of Islam happened as a result of so many of Muhammad's relatives being, you know, getting caliphates and becoming imams and this and that, and the kind of infighting that occurred,
mm-hmm.
right, persists to this day and formed the Shia and Sunni sects. And so all of that became fraught with difficulty. And some might say that we can talk about that further. I regretfully will not be on next week's show, when we're going to be covering Philip and Nathaniel and perhaps Matthew, depending on how far we go. But it's looking like this is shaping up to be more like a 5 or a 6-part series. So I want to just say thank you so much, God's Gumshoe, for joining us here on the program. Your insight, your experience, your knowledge of your biblical studies and knowledge from ministry is all very, very helpful, and appreciate that very, very much. So thank you for joining us. And Crystalyn, it's always a pleasure being with you here, sister.
Ditto for me.
Yeah.
And
so,
next week, Paula should be back.
Paula will be back. And it should be a wonderful show. Yes. I will look forward to listening in on the archive. And that's just to remind our listeners that if they miss any portion, they can always come back and listen to the archived version and listen to any portion that they want to, and, of course, skip any portion they don't want to.
Remember also to tune in on Sundays to hear God's Gumshoe and his in-depth research on biblical matters that relate to the Ridge book.
Oh, yeah.
Which I have done many times and have found very valuable. I love your approach of hearing, you know, first what, you know, common popular Christianity looks at, then what biblical scholarship looks at, and then what the Urantia book looks at, so that there's a tripartite look at these, whatever you're studying out of biblical Christianity.
Thank you.
So having said that, thank you, all of you, and we hope to have you here again next week on Cosmic Citizen. Bye for now.
Bye,
bye
all.
For now.
hope to have you here again.